www.ccc.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted that you are with us again on this Sunday afternoon. We will not take calls today for those of you who are hoping to do calls, but we will in the next week or two. We had a lot of great calls last week, and we'll probably have some more great calls in the next week or two.
Always send emails.
Always send emails, right. You can also send our, we have a new email here, you know, here at Mike or Lorene at WMNF. So you can send it to us. Either one works, and I'll still give you my personal email just in case you're having problems with it. It's Deason, Deeson, .media, Media, at gmail.com. I might not be able to answer them all, but we will address them on the show, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, our first segment, and I was getting a rough time because I haven't come up with the jingle yet. It's News for Jews,
news
which we
always...
So we have a lot today, and a lot of it is ugly, quite frankly.
Right.
And starting off with a shooting in Miami last week. Talk a little bit about
that. That was Sunday. That was after our program last Sunday at the synagogue in North Miami Beach. Young Israel Lipschutz, he was 69 years old. He was sitting outside on the bench in front of the synagogue waiting for evening prayer, as he normally does when a driver stopped his car, got out of the vehicle, and spent about 20 to 30 seconds shooting him, like just a barrage of bullets. He was hit several times, but fortunately, he got to the hospital quick enough and seems to be doing better, is on the way to recovery. But this is very frightening news. This was, police at the time, at least the early report said they didn't know yet if it was a hate crime. I mean, to me, this is a pretty obvious hate crime. You have an identifiable Jew sitting in front of a synagogue waiting for evening prayer. But
you would think if something like that happened that it was obviously a hate crime,
right? And we'll keep track of this, and we'll see what happens if someone is ultimately charged with a hate crime. We'll obviously report on it. I think it's important for the community to stay vigilant, stay aware, and be safe.
And unfortunately, incidents like this are happening not only in our country, but throughout the world. A Berlin rabbi was verbally abused and spat upon on one of several recent attacks in Berlin. In Berlin, it's anti-Semitism is on the rise. We have to be aware of that. It's unpleasant news, obviously very unpleasant news, but we can't stick our head in the sand and pretend that it's not happening.
Right. Well, what about the cartoon that was in one of the major papers in Norway? It reminded me of the cartoon that they played in the New York Times a couple months back, where they had a caricature of Donald Trump with a leash with a dog that had a little kippah on the Jewish star, and in essence, the Jewish dog. I mean, I can't even, it's still unfathomable to me that the New York Times ran that cartoon. Obviously, they retracted it and apologized for it, but still. And so we see in Norway this satirical cartoon of an obvious, observant Jew who's playing Scrabble, and he's trying to think of a word to play, and like, do I play, do I not play it, and in the language, it was, I'm probably going to say this wrong, but in the Norwegian language is Jodesvin, which meant Jewish swine, and he was trying to decide whether or not to play the word to win the Scrabble game. This caricature saying, in essence, calling Jews Jewish swine.
It was extremely, extremely offensive and clearly anti-Semitic, but it ran in a major newspaper. Now, you don't think of Norway as a country where there's anti-Semitism. At least I didn't, but clearly that's not the case.
Right. Well, normally when we think of Norway, we think of it as being this society that tolerates other religions and differences, but there has been increasing levels of anti-Semitism in that country. And I think all of these things throughout all of Europe that we've seen consistently over the last decade in particular, need to be alarming. And that's why people need to be more vocal in speaking out when we see this, that we can't just look the other way.
And the newspaper said that they didn't think it was anti-Semitic. They said, take the words out of context, it is, but it was satirical in the cartoon. And that's why
I don't understand how it's satirical with a Jewish-looking guy playing Scrabble, saying, "Do I play the word Jewish swine? Yes or no?"
I mean,
how is, like, what is that? What's the satire in that? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. But I think it's important for all of us who are Jewish to let people know. So I think there are people who say anti-Semitic things and have no clue that what they're saying is blatantly offensive.
Right, right. I mean, you and I had a conversation with someone a couple weeks back where they continually made references in this conversation about, you know, well, your people are powerful. And I'm just sitting there with my mouth open like, okay, right. So you people, who are you people? The Jews? So we control all the state legislatures? I'm just sitting there thinking to myself like, oh my God, you people are powerful. How do you not know that that is just a, like the typical common anti-Semitic statement?
Well, yeah, I was sitting next to Laureen when that was said, and I thought I was going to have to tackle her and put her back in the chair. She is, yeah, I'm a fairly fiery person, but I am really mellow compared to her. And I thought she might reach across the table and strangle that. You were really upset. I could tell you were really upset.
Yeah,
obviously.
but it's true. I think people say these things sometimes. They don't appreciate, you know, what they're actually saying to a Jew, that why it would be offensive. So I don't think it's fair to say they're all anti-Semitic. I think sometimes they're making anti-Semitic statements and may not even realize it. And that's why what we're doing is so important. I think it's educating people.
And I think we have to speak up as Jews. If you hear something like that, you got to say, man, that is offensive. And I've been in situations like that where someone has said to me, wow, It never occurred to me. I mean, there are people who say anti-Semitic things that might not necessarily be anti-Semitic.
Right.
I mean, it's a fine line. It's a lack of education and understanding, and walk a mile in our shoes.
Right. I mean, I remember being on I was on a cruise one time, and like the couple was sitting with us. We were out shopping, and like, oh, you know, we come back and we had a bunch of stuff that we had bought, and like, oh, did you Jew them down? I'm like,
oh.
Like, really?
Well, you know,
no one had ever actually said that to me before. I was young. This is like over 20 years ago. Uh-huh. But I remember thinking to myself, like, wow, okay, no. I got a good deal, but no.
Well, the one time I didn't say anything about this was during the whole purchase of the Bucks by the Glazers. A lot of people didn't know that I was Jewish. Deason is not necessarily a Jewish sounding name. And they would say some terrible things about the Glazers. Oh, absolutely. And what I did, I just made a little mental note in my head saying, this icon of the community is an anti-Semite.
Wow.
And I thought it served me better at that point to know that and stock it away instead of saying something right there. I wondered at the time, should I have said, excuse me, by the way, I'm Jewish too, but I just filed that information away. But some of the icons of our community said some really, really disparaging things about the Glazers. Because
that's horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible. It was the worst episode in that whole episode. And you know, it's ironic. This is way off topic, but we get like that. You realize the owners of the three major sports franchises in Tampa Bay,
right,
are Jewish.
Right, Jeff Fenech, absolutely.
Jeff Fenech, Stu Sternberg, and the Glazers.
And they're all tremendous philanthropists. They do so much for our community.
They give so much back to the community.
That's really a bad
rap on the Glazers, that they don't participate in our community.
They do so much.
The Glazer JCC, which used to be Homer Hesterly Armory. I don't know. Were you
the Glazer family?
The Glazer family.
JCC. Yes. That. I mean, you talk about the Children's Museum downtown, and just so much of the other giving that they do that people don't necessarily hear about. They're huge. I mean, and with Jeff and Penny both do with the arts, and $50,000 a game to a charity. I mean, it is just crazy, the financial impact and the benefit that he's had to our community.
Absolutely,
so.
Absolutely.
All right, so we got more news.
Okay, I want to talk about the Jewish tweets targeted by white supremacists. That's really scary. There was a Jewish Journal columnist, Ariel Sobel, who's written before about issues and harassment of Jewish women. And oftentimes on social media for support, people will put, I am a Jew. You've seen it on Facebook with the star or I stand with it and all. Well, white supremacist groups are collecting these names. This is really frightening. This is really frightening. And finally, she had to come out on Twitter and say, please don't say I am a Jew and I support you. On so many levels, that's wrong. First of all, with the white supremacists. Secondly, not being able to say I am a Jew.
Well, I think it's another way of control and fear, right? It's control and fear tactics, which is what we've always seen. And people, look, and Jews Jews are very good at hiding. They've been hiding for several thousand years. I mean, because of the Inquisitions and the different persecutions. I mean, they know. They understand the ramifications of being outwardly out there as a Jew. So it's frightening, and I think it's a fear tactic. So I appreciate what she said, but I also think that there is something even more powerful in the statement when people say, you know what, I stand with the Jews, and even when Jews and non-Jews just say, we're just going to deluge you with a bunch of tweets that say, I'm a Jew, and just, you know, look, we stand with them, we're going to send a strong message. I think, to me, that's a more powerful statement back at the haters
that are
trying to, because then they don't succeed in their fear and intimidation tactics, right?
Right.
I think that's probably the best response that one can do.
And speaking of the Crusade, which if you weren't paying attention, Lori, just mentioned that a second or two ago. See, I listened to you. In Spain, they are allowing Sephardic Jews to become Spanish citizens.
Well, this is exciting. I mean, Spain and Portugal. So Spain opened it up, I want to say like 8 years ago or something. I remember this. I shared that story about my mother.
That's a great story.
I was like all excited. I remember reading the article one day, like Spain's opening, like if you're a Sephardic Jew, you can, you know, get your passport and everything. And I remember going to my mother like, Mom, this is really exciting. Her reaction to me was, it's a trap. And I'm like, really? You know? That's a typical, like, it's a trap. Yeah, they want to bring us all back and kill us. Like, we didn't kill you the first time, we're going to get you now. But I think that's the mindset of many, right? I mean, the many Jews who, you know, obviously went through that persecution. It's a mindset. It actually made me stop and think, maybe it was, they've had success.
No, that's very, but you know what we ought to do, because there are some people who aren't Jewish who are listening to this show, and they have no idea what we're talking about, Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazi Jews. I mean,
and the Mizrahi Jews.
And the Mizrahi Jews, but no, I mean, so we ought to explain that. The Sephardic Jews are mostly from Africa and Spain
and Portugal and Northern Africa, right?
The Ashkenazis are Russia and Germany and all that. And then the Mizrahi Jews, we featured someone the other day.
The Mizrahi. Now, a lot of the Mizrahi Jews are from Northern Africa and all over the Middle East. And many of those Mizrahi Jews as well in Northern Africa were originally Sephardic Jews from Spain. They went to the countries in Northern Africa to avoid the Inquisition persecution. So very interesting. Then you have the Benai Jews that are from India and China.
And the Ethiopian.
The Ethiopian Jews. So just, you know, there's Jews in pretty much every culture in every continent.
And we, you know, we are the same, but we are different. For example, the Ashkenazi Jews carry a disease called Tay-Sachs that if both parents have that, the child can have the disease. It's a debilitating disease. The kids don't live long. As a matter of fact, my wife and I, when my wife was pregnant, because we are both Ashkenazi Jews, we took a test to see if we carried that recessive gene.
Right. And the BRCA gene, which is related to breast cancer, is also found mostly predominantly in the Ashkenazi Jews, but not in the other groups. So it's interesting. But what I thought was really powerful, there was this article that came out. It was, I believe, in the Times of Israel on July 31st yesterday that was talking about the 10,000 Sephardi Jews that were close to becoming citizens again of Portugal. And what they said, just reading from this article, on the newly Spanish citizens that were naturalized, that there was predominantly from Turkey and Venezuela. So they had, between 2015 and 2018, they had 2,693 new citizens from Turkey and 1,487 citizens from Venezuela. The third largest group of Sephardic Jews that had applied for Spanish citizenship were the Sephardic Jews in Israel, 860. So that was really interesting that they had, you know, that of all those that they had processed, predominantly the Sephardic Jews wanting to return to Spain or get that citizenship were from Turkey and Venezuela.
Well, Venezuela, you can understand why.
Anyone would want to get out, right?
Right. This is not a great time to be in Venezuela. But
yeah.
But that's sort of interesting. One other thing I wanted to tell you about, I don't know if you're aware of that. We were talking about the debates. I'm a political junkie. I was watching the whole thing. Did you know Marianne Williamson is Jewish?
I do. And I think that's, you know, I mean, maybe we'll get to that a little bit in our with our guest today. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we'll touch on it because we're going to be talking a lot. But she's, you know, she's Jewish, but and she doesn't practice Judaism. She's a spiritualist.
She's very
successful.
Oprah loves her.
Very, very successful motivational speaker, etc. But interesting that, I mean, part of that growing statistic of Jews who don't identify themselves religiously as being a Jew.
That's right. And that's, you know what? That's what we're going to talk about next, because there were some surprising statistics from a survey by the Pew Group, and we're going to talk about that and be back in just about a minute or so. Listening to the Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I am Mike Deason.
This is Lorene Jaffe.
And we are delighted you are here, and we're also delighted that we have two guests in the studio who happen to be both of our rabbis, Rabbi Joel Simon.
Hello.
And Rabbi Nathan Farb of Shehera Zedek.
Hi, it's great to be here.
We're really thrilled. This started, Rabbi Farb sent me an email because we had a segment on News for Jews a couple of weeks ago about the Israeli education minister equating marriage out of Judaism, interfaith marriages, as being akin to the Holocaust, which was, I thought, pretty over the top. But still in all, it was interesting to hear that. And then Rabbi Farb said, well, wait a second. It's not as bad as that. There's a whole study. Mm-hmm. Tell us about it.
Yeah, there are multiple studies of the Jewish population, and one of the most recent significant ones was the Pew Research study in 2013. There are lots of different interpretations of the results that they found, but I'd like to talk about some of those. Before I do that, I think it's important to talk about why, as Jews, we care about intermarriage, because I think for people who are not Jewish, it's a sort of a strange topic to be discussing how this affects our community. I think that it really comes from and the mentality that led to that comment on your show a couple weeks ago that you mentioned, comparing intermarriage with the Shoah, with the Holocaust. It's not the first time that that's been said, and it comes from this mentality of self-preservation. You know, the world Jewish population by proportion is 0.00196 of the world population. We're just a tiny sliver, just a tiny proportion of the world population. The United States, which after Israel has the greatest concentration of Jewish population, even here we're 0.0176. of the U.S. population, just a tiny.
So that was one less zero.
That was one less zero. Well,
let me tell you what.
It's under 2%, between 1% and 2% of the U.S. population, and the world population, it's a tenth of that percentage.
To put this in perspective, yeah. I did an interview with a California legislator who happens to be Jewish. His name's Jesse Gabriel, and he told me that in California there are more Latinos than Jews in the United States, which was a staggering statistic to me about, first off, the amount of Latinos in California, but the lack of Jewish population throughout the United States. It sort of puts it in perspective.
Yet that wasn't surprising to me.
It wasn't. Yeah.
And it's not surprising, and that's why, you know, Hispanic Americans are not, the leaders of the Hispanic American community are not talking about worrying about whether or not there will be Hispanic Americans in another generation or two.
Absolutely.
But that is a discussion in the Jewish community because we're such a small proportion. And that's where this nervousness historically about intermarriage comes from, that if all of our children marry non-Jews, this is the argument, then their children will not continue to be Jewish. And there's a lot of fear that that means the end of the Jewish people, which is where these really over-the-top hyperbolic comments come from. But they are just not they're completely out of touch with reality.
So let me ask you a question, because when the Pew study came out in 2013, it was a major red flag for, you know, like the leadership council within the Jewish world. The federations, everyone was sort of looking at this and what can we do? How can we stop it? Because people obviously, it was alarming when you see a 30% decline over the last several generations of those who actually identify themselves religiously as being Jewish or not. But you had a different take on it. I think, when you wrote Mike and I, one that maybe is more of a positive spin that says it's not the end of the world. that the self-preservation is very important to Judaism. And, we've managed to survive through, thousands of years of different horrific circumstances. So what now? How are we going to survive this?
Yeah, and there's some, to me, counterintuitive statistics that the Pew study found.
Yeah, so let me talk, first of all, just a simple thought experiment that will totally, for any of your Jewish listeners, will totally reframe how you think about intermarriage. If you've got two young Jewish folks, and they get married to each other, they form one Jewish household. If those same two get married outside of the faith, they're bringing other people in. You have now two potentially Jewish households, which is where the idea of intermarriage potentially expanding the Jewish population.
Now that's where Rabbi Farb might be the fifth opinion. I don't want to sound like we're, at least from my perspective, that we're encouraging it. I think that always a goal of Jewish youth programs in Hillel is having Jews meet other Jews, and if that leads to relationships, wonderful. But what it also says is the responsibility on the Jewish community in making sure that interfaith couples who want a Jewish home have the support in making that Jewish home. And that's where the research that Rabbi Farb has is so great. And my gratitude to Rabbi Farb for having the research. I used to have time to read articles, and then between becoming the senior rabbi of an almost 1,200 family synagogue and having two kids, the time for that reading went down a little bit, but I'm very grateful to have Rabbi Farb in the office down the hall.
And I want to get back to the statistics, but I do want to say something that, now this is coming from a jaundiced view because I'm a member of Sarah Zedek, so is Laureen, but it seems like our congregation goes out of its way to make intermarried couples feel at home. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's really something that started under Rabbi Bernholtz's senior rabbinate and is only expanding, where a family who has decided to have a Jewish home, and again, that doesn't require two Jewish parents, that doesn't require the non-Jewish spouse to convert, or even to not be practicing. We have a lot of families where one parent actively practices another religion, but they're raising their children solely Jewish. And we want to celebrate those families. So the non-Jewish parent is considered a full member of the congregation, is welcome to, when we have a bar bat mitzvah, the non-Jewish parent is included in everything the Jewish parent is, holds the Torah, passes the Torah on to their child because they're passing on Judaism to the next generation, even though they're not Jewish. One compromise that Rabbi Bernholtz made, two decades ago, maybe 30 years ago, when he first started officiating at interfaith marriages, when it was very controversial in a Reform synagogue for the rabbi to officiate, was that he wouldn't do them on the bima. That was, again, a board 20, 30 years ago, and that was a way to do it. But just this past June, I officiated at the first interfaith wedding on the Shaarei Tzedek Bima. Again, this is a couple who is committed to raising Jewish children, and the wife happens to be Hindu, but loves what Judaism offers to a family, has been celebrating Jewish holidays with the family for a long time. And just as she would be welcome on the Bima during their future children's B'nai Mitzvah, it made sense for them to be married on our Bima as well.
That is very cool. But it's not surprising with the statistics you have about the fact that they're raising their kids Jewish, because what the Pew study shows is with a split marriage.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about that.
Well, and beyond that, you know, the percentage is right about 50%. I don't want to drill down too far into the numbers just for the sake of time, but our goal as a Jewish community is to bring those numbers to up as high as we can. One of the best ways that we have found through studies to do that, there's a 2016 Brandeis study that shows having a rabbi as the sole officiant at a wedding is a tremendous predictor of Jewish involvement. For example, among a couple that is in married, meaning both partners are Jewish, the odds are 94% that they're going to raise their first child Jewish. Among a couple that is interfaith, that is married by a rabbi, the chances are 85% that they'll raise their first child Jewish, a little bit lower, but almost within the margin of error. Now, you take that same couple, an interfaith couple, not married by a rabbi, and it drops all the way down below 25%, 23% chance of raising their first child as Jewish.
That's good news for you guys, business for you.
Yeah.
I think that explains why the decision by Rabbi Bernholz originally and now by you, so smart, Rabbi Simon. If we want to continue, when you're looking at the Pew study, you're looking at the statistics, if you know that we can guarantee, based upon the data, that we are going to be able to keep the next generation involved in Judaism and raise Jewish families, and then they would hopefully go on and raise Jewish families. I mean, this is about self-preservation. It's also about, you know, from my perspective, sharing Jewish values, which I think so many people connect to, regardless of what religion and faith background they come from. I think it's just, you know, there's so much to share there and pass on from one generation to the next. I mean, so tell us about sort of how, maybe some other experiences of how you're incorporating these ideals into the community.
Yeah, I think a big part of it is, you know, relaying why values are important, but also as much as possible not being judgmental. So for all of the clergy at Shaarei Tzedek, for us to officiate at a wedding, it's not just any couple who comes in our door will officiate. The couple has to commit to having a Jewish home and raising Jewish children. And if they want a co-officiated wedding, so co-officiation between a rabbi and non-Jewish clergy, or if they say, you know, we're planning on raising our children half and half, which that can be another interview for another day. But just as, you know, none of us can say, well, I'm half Jewish and half Christian, you know, that doesn't work theologically. That's really saying I'm going to celebrate Hanukkah and I'm going to celebrate Christmas, but the religion isn't going to be a part of my life. So we do have values and standards that we relay. But it's also saying that we're open to what's going to happen in your home and want to be a part of it. So we don't say to a non-Jewish parent that if you're having a Jewish family, you can't have a Christmas tree in the home. The lesson, again, that I learned from Rabbi Bernholz is compare it to a birthday, that we celebrate Dad's birthday and we have a birthday party for Dad, but that doesn't mean that it's my birthday. So what we can explain to our kids is we celebrate Christmas either with Dad or with Dad's family or Mom's family. My wife wasn't born Jewish, so we celebrate Christmas with her family, and explain to our children that that's not our holiday, but we celebrate it because it's important to them. Funny story, my daughter, 3.5 years old, is Santa Claus crazy. That happened before she had done this. And you know, we said to her, all right, we're going to go celebrate Christmas with Aunt Jamie and Uncle Chris, and we're celebrating it with them because it's their holiday, even though it's not our holiday. And my sweet, sweet daughter looks at me and says, but Daddy, if we're celebrating Christmas with them because it's their holiday, even though we don't celebrate it, we're still kind of celebrating Christmas, right? And I had to give her that one. But again,
it's very little smart whippersnapper.
But it's saying that there are things that are important, and that when we make sure that our families see the value of having that Jewish home and raising Jewish children and having those Jewish experiences. And I tell every couple, every interfaith couple, that the most important thing to me is that their kids have a religious identity. And that might not be Jewish. You know, they might decide that they're going to raise their kids in another religion. And that doesn't mean that the Jewish partner isn't welcome in our synagogue and that they don't celebrate Jewish holidays with their Jewish parent, just like I'm saying they can do with a non-Jewish parent. And if they make that choice, we're going to support them 100% as well, even though obviously we're not going to be the ones officiating at the wedding. We want healthy families first. And if they want Judaism to be a part of those families, then we want to be a part of it in whatever way we can be, while still sticking to the values that are most important to us.
And one other topic that was mentioned in the survey, and this could be perhaps a whole other show, right, was talking about millennials who don't identify at all with any religion. That's problematic.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting trend. It could be problematic. Again, like some of these things, that whether or not it's problematic depends on your interpretation. But here are two pieces of data that I think are interesting and relevant. First is, if you look overall at religion in America, association with religion is declining. The nuns, as they call N-O-N-E,
not the ones with the habit.
Right? The nuns that mean you have an extremely high religious affiliation.
Yes. the religion of none, meaning no religion, yeah. has climbed in the past 40 years from 5% in 1972. The latest numbers I have are 2012. I'm sure there's more recent, which is 20%. It's gone from 5% to 20% of Americans across all religions. Religious affiliation is just a totally different mindset in America. But at the same time, if you look at adults who came from interfaith families, you compare by generation, each generation that goes on, more and more of those kids, when they become adults, are identifying with Judaism. So if you look at 65 and over folks, you're talking about something like 18% that identify as Jewish. Now you compare that with millennials, the 18 to 29, that's way up at 50% of those kids grow
up. That's a staggering
jump.
Right.
Yeah. It really increases with each generation, which shows that the inclusion and the outreach we've been doing for the past 20 years is working.
I was going to say, what accounts for that? But that does make sense, that if you say you are welcome here, that you know, you're not a pariah because one of your parents isn't Jewish. That's a big difference.
And I think specifically when we're talking about millennials, the idea of membership to any community or any group is changing. Yeah. The idea of shopping for the best deal in anyone's situation is such a part of who we are, and I can say we, and that's definitely a topic for another time, but it's something that a lot of research is being done and a lot of work is being done, and it's just so important to show everyone that whether you're a member or not, that we care about you and we want you to be a part of our community, and looking at different ways to think about what that outreach means, whether you have two Jewish parents or not. So that's a different conversation than one that we're happy to have anytime.
Well, we'll have to do it again. The rabbis, I thank you so much for coming in today. And we want to have you back again.
It was
again.
A treat.
It
yes,
was a real
thank
treat.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. And this is the Third Opinion. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. You're listening to The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Thiessen.
This is Laureen Jaffe.
And this is WMNF 88.5. We are delighted that you are here with us today. You know, when we do this show, obviously we're dealing with some controversial issues. Some people
yes.
like what we say. Some people don't like what we say. Okay.
Sometimes you feel like that, sometimes you don't, Mike.
That's right.
So we did get some feedback from a particular listener regarding the video we played, in particular about Hamas and whether or not the right of return was a peaceful protest and what they're doing. So there was a piece run, and it was in the Times of Israel, May 17th, 2018, where there's a clip and a transcript of statements being made at the time by senior Hamas official, Mahmoud al-Zahar. So that's a senior Hamas official in Gaza, where the protests were being taken place. And this is what he's saying. This is what he's saying to the people in Gaza. And these are his words. This is his quote. "This is not a peaceful resistance. It is supported by weapons." Senior Hamas official, this is Hamas official Mohammed al-Zahar said that Hamas was employing peaceful resistance bolstered by a military force and by security agencies and enjoying tremendous popular support. Speaking on Al Jazeera on May 13th, al-Zahar, former foreign minister for the Hamas government, said that the option of armed struggle has not diminished. On the contrary, it is growing and developing, he said. So, you know, he's making this point about it not being a peaceful resistance. He also went on to boast that when you are in possession of weapons that were able to withstand the occupation in the wars of 2006, 2008, 2012, and 2014, when you have weapons that are being wielded by men who were able to prevent the strongest army in the region from entering the Gaza Strip for 51 days and were able to capture and kill soldiers of that army, is this really peaceful resistance? He asked, meaning al-Zahar asked. And then in comment to Fatah, because again, for those of you who are not particularly familiar with the region, so the Fatah government led by Abu Abbas in the West Bank is different than the Hamas terrorist government that leads the territory of the Palestinian people in Gaza, which is on the southwest coastline of Israel. And they don't get along. The two governments do not get along. In fact, when Hamas was elected into power in 2005, they killed in the streets members of the Fatah. So this is what he says about the Fatah. He says, "As for Fatah's peaceful resistance, it consists of rallies, demonstrations, protest pleas, and requests in order to improve the terms of negotiations or to enable talks with the Israeli enemy," he said. "This deception does not fool the Palestinian public." In essence, he's mad at Fatah for not being violent, rather for being peaceful. And he knows it is not. Hamas's intent and intention has never been, as they have aligned more and more with Iran, to be peaceful.
Yeah, the issue from last week is we played a clip from Israeli TV about Israeli soldiers saying that Hamas was using children, women, and old people as shields. And unfortunately, obviously, women, children, and old people, Palestinians who are just trying to live their lives, have ended up as collateral damage, which there's no excuse for it. There's no excuse. But if Hamas is using these people to be able to lob grenades and weapons across the border, it's an untenable situation. What do you do?
Right. I mean, look, you know, even the U.S. Congress has condemned Hamas for utilization of women, children, elderly as human shields. And what I thought was really interesting, the European Parliament, the EU, did that in April 2018 as well. I mean, and the EU is not known as being a friend of Israel. And here they are condemning Hamas for the use of human shields. I think that's this, you know, look, you can be passionate about a side, but at the end of the day, I mean, don't come and tell us that it's a peaceful protest when there's journalists with live footage and videos that we've seen and how they're manipulating these children. I mean, what if they came, you know, and told your children in your neighborhood, hey, get on a bus, we're going to the border to protest, and, you know, and they've got grenades and things and utilization of force, and they're putting your kids right in the midst of that. I mean, I'm sorry, if somebody drove up to your school next door and at the elementary school and did that, you'd be like, no way in hell. But can I say hell?
Yeah, you can say that.
But you know, it's just something to be thinking about. I mean, it is not a peaceful protest, and please don't turn a blind eye to facts and the truth is all I'm asking of our listeners. Be open-minded.
I want to play a clip. This is from the United Nations, where a bunch of countries, mostly from the Middle East, who hate Israel, are talking about how terrible Israel is, what it does to the Palestinians, how it treats people poorly. And then there was a man who addressed this UN committee that was condemning Israel.
A former member of Hamas.
A former Hamas member. So we're going to start off with the clip, and you're going to hear just terrible things about Israel. But I think this is a poignant piece of information to give us a little bit of an idea about what is really going on from someone on the inside.
Occupying power continues with its colonial policy and its daily violations. It continues to abuse, to arbitrarily detain, to carry out ethnic cleansing, steal land and natural resources, uproot trees, steal money, Israeli activity to Judaize Jerusalem, demolition of homes, confiscation of land and property, spoiling of natural resources.
Racist violations perpetrated by Israel.
Israel continues to commit various forms of human rights violations in Palestine.
Israel, the occupying power, is advancing in its efforts of mass colonization and continued apartheid, put an end to this colonialist regime.
Apartheid, atrocities, and massive destruction inflicted on the Palestinian people.
War crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and state terror.
Thank you, United Nations Watch.
Shukran Sayyid Rais. I take the floor on behalf of the UN Watch. My name is Mus'ab Hassan Youssef. I grew up in Ramallah as a member of Hamas. I address the words to the Palestinian Authority, which claims to be the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. I ask, where does your legitimacy come from? The Palestinian people did not elect you, and they did not appoint you to represent them. You are self-appointed. Your accountability is not to your own people. This is evidenced by your own total violation for their human rights. In fact, the Palestinian individual and their human development is the least of your concerns. You kidnap Palestinian students from campus and torture them in your jails. You torture your political rivals. The suffering of the Palestinian people is the outcome of your selfish political interest. You are the greatest enemy of the Palestinian people. If Israel did not exist, you would have no one to blame. Take responsibility for the outcome of your own actions. You fan the flames of conflict to maintain your abusive power. Finally, you use this platform to mislead the international community, to mislead the Palestinian society, to believe that Israel is responsible for the problems you create. Thank you.
Wow. It's pretty powerful.
It is. And I think, you know, it speaks to, by the way, both the Fatah party, which is very corrupt. I mean, you know, you got Mahmoud Abbas refusing. Israel's trying to pay the Palestinian Authority $200 million in taxes that they collect that goes to the Palestinian Authority every month. And Mahmoud Abbas has been rejecting. He's been denying, no, I don't want them. So he's denying his own people those funds, that Israel's collecting for them. This is an ongoing criticism of Abbas right now by many.
Well, but Abbas is so weak compared. I mean,
oh, right. Oh, compared to Hamas, but this goes to, like, corruption's on both sides. Then you have Hamas, which, and I think this goes to the point that we made multiple times on the show. If you actually love the Palestinian people, you care about human rights, and stop turning a blind eye to this monster of an actor that holds these people hostage, and it's a gruesome rule. It's a tyrannical rule. These people are living horrible lives, and, you know, let's call it what it is. When they're not built, when they're, I gave the quote the other day of how many billions of dollars been poured in the last several years, and the money instead is being spent on building terror tunnels. Very expensive equipment is utilized for that, by the way. And child labor is being used. Forget the fact that if you're gay and you're openly gay, you'll be shot dead on the streets. That people have sought refuge in Israel because Palestinians, because they were gay and they didn't want to be killed. I mean, these are things that are happening every day there. You need to understand the oppression that they're under instead of always pointing the finger saying it's Israel, Israel, Israel. Really, how about the tyrannical, authoritarian government government that's oppressive and ruining their lives and doesn't care about them. All they care about, all Hamas cares about, is the destruction of Israel.
Israel does not have the right to exist.
Right. That's all they care about. They don't care about their own people. That's what's alarming. I mean, there's no, you know, so, and that's why I think the message I think we've tried to get through, and hopefully we will get through to people. I mean, you know, look, there's things that happen on both sides. No government is perfect, but please don't tell me that you love the Palestinian people and then turn a blind eye to the atrocities that are occurring by Hamas and their government.
And you know what I don't understand when the United Nations gets into its diatribes about Israel, like we just heard? What about the other countries throughout the world that are so oppressive toward their people?
Syria, the Democratic Congo.
Saudi Arabia.
Congo, right. Turkey is doing horrific things. What's happening? Just all over the Middle East. And I mean, it's just Indonesia, women being caned, you know, under Sharia law. They use Sharia law as an excuse, you know, for executions and beatings of women. Israel was always, I mean, until former Ambassador Nikki Haley was always on the agenda. It was always agenda item. But then you have people like, you know, Syria and Korea, North Korea, et cetera, who are on the council for UN human rights. I mean, like, come on.
Well, you know, I mentioned last week that I went to Saudi Arabia before the first Gulf War to cover it. And there was a day when we were invited, nobody took up on it, to go, if we wanted to a public square to see hands chopped off and executions. Oh. And it was like, we said, nah, thank you very much. But there are barbaric things going on in other countries in the Middle East, and the UN just turns a blind eye.
Right.
An American journalist was killed by the crown prince of Saudi Arabia,
right,
and nobody says boo about it in the United Nations.
Right, and by the way, and these atrocities are also, you know, in the Palestinian Authority, you have things happening. I mean, you read reports of, it was recently, a man sold, you know, in Hebron, he sold his home to a Jew, and he was killed. And I think they killed his son also. You know, they just shot down. There's no justice system. There's no courts of law. No, I mean, this is what happens.
It's frontier justice.
Right, it's frontier justice, and it's always about, and nobody wants to talk about it. So it's always Israel. And I think that's the point we try to make on this show, that, come on, guys, like, look, we hear it all day long. There's plenty of Israel bashing, and it's been constant for, you know, 70 years now. We've heard it.
Since 1948, that's right. Well, no, it's true.
71 years now,
yeah. Well, it's coming up on, yeah.
Right.
But and the thing that's scary, though, about the other countries is some of this lack of tolerance is moving toward Europe. Look at the government that's now in Hungary. Look at the anti-Semitism that's rising again throughout Europe. I find it frightening.
Right. You know, look, I've been watching it for a while. I think France, where the largest Jewish population in modern day lived, you know, you see the attacks in the grocery store. You saw the attacks when the terrorists went into the Jewish day school, the Orthodox Jewish day school, and was shooting down students and literally, like, took this little girl who was, you know, maybe 5 years old and threw her down on the ground and shot her in the head. I mean, this is the reality of what's happening right now throughout Europe, and that's why we read articles, you know, like that from Norway, and I've seen similar things in Spain and, you know, all over Europe. It's alarming. It's frightening.
Okay, we're going to take one more break, and we'll be back right after this. You're listening to The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I'm Mike Deason.
This is Lorene Jaffe.
And we're glad you're here. You know, one of the things that we want to do is feature positive things, not only talk about negative things.
Right.
I ran across a clip from Mayim Bialik, who was Amy Farrah Fowler on the The Big Bang Theory. Hello.
Big Bang Theory.
Little mind fart there. I want to play this clip from her on why she's religious. Oh, wait, I can't do that without this. Mike, stop that. Let me do this. Here we go.
I'm often asked about and sometimes criticized for being a religious person. Why would a scientist be religious? Why would someone who knows so much about the universe believe in mythology and magic? Why do you need religion as a crutch? That's what people ask me. First of all, that's not how I see religion. And second of all, a huge aspect of what I find so appealing about religion is the opportunity to focus on mindfulness. Yes, part of this is accomplished in my religious practice by a connection with something greater than myself, which we do tend to call God. But the rituals and the methodology of religion can be a vehicle. At least this is my experience in Judaism, a vehicle. So how does an ancient religion like Judaism feel relevant in the 21st century? Well, Judaism in its original state was actually designed to introduce a concept of mindfulness. How? Well, one way is by instituting prayer throughout the day. Muslims actually do this too. Religious Jews pray three times a day. Once in the morning, once in the afternoon, and once in the evening. However, the entire day is full of opportunities for prayer and mindfulness. In Judaism, we have blessings before and after eating. There's a blessing for after you visit the bathroom, seeing lofty mountains, or eating a fruit for the first time, or even meeting someone who is exceptionally unusual looking. Yes. That's a thing. The notion of mindfulness is a constant exercise for Jews. And while we may hone our mindfulness with an awareness of something that we call God, for some people, they use the notion of the universe at large, or the love that binds us all, or a mystical concept of oneness. So you can be mindful even if you are an intellectual or philosophically oriented person. I don't feel that my scientist self is compromised at all by participating in things like meditation, yoga, deep breathing, and even prayer, all of which have been found to lower blood pressure, increase your body's ability to heal, and basically improve your quality of life overall. Do I have issues with religion? Heck yeah. Do I have a strong distaste for the patriarchal flair of Judeo-Christianity? Yes, ma'am. Do I have concerns that certain religious beliefs and political leanings that are in line with those religious beliefs might contribute to a world of hate and destruction rather than one of love and unity? Absolutely. Would I be a good scientist if I didn't? Do you see what I did there? But I am grateful to the approach that my religion has taken to increase mindfulness. I'm grateful that I can connect with this trend in popular culture while still having it be completely consistent with the ancient religion that is mine. You can practice mindfulness without religion, absolutely. But for me, there is something very, very special about combining that awareness with thousands of years of ritual and tradition and with this thing that is greater than myself, which I choose to call God. And honestly, that's why I'm religious. For me, practicing Judaism means committing to a structure of intention and meaning, which brings my life mindfulness and purpose.
Love it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes. Yeah. So I just that really quickly. I mean, I think in the Torah teaches us obviously to meditate on the word because it's a tree of life, and that's why we do it, right? And
right.
And that's why I meditate on Tehillim regularly, because I think to me that's life. So. Go Mayim. So quickly, one other last piece of news before we wrap up for the day. We thought this was a positive thing. This week in Israel, the Security Cabinet approved plans and granted Palestinians 700 building permits in Area C. Area C, just so you all know, according to the Oslo Accords, is controlled by Israel. The Oslo Accords gave Israel full military and administrative control over that area, which compromises about 60% of the West Bank. So Israel will be, under unanimous support, providing, that's Benjamin Netanyahu's government will be granting those 700 building permits for Palestinians in that Israeli-controlled area to build, along with 6,000 licenses for homes in neighboring settlements.
And this is theoretically a country that does not give Palestinians any rights. That's a good way to wrap up the show.
Great work, Mike.
Okay, that's it for us. Thank you. We'll be back next week. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
This is The Third Opinion.
You're listening to WMNF Tampa. I'm Joy Katzen-Guthrie. Welcome to the Sunday Simcha.